Hi, I'm Lucia.
And I'm Nell, and this is Totally Normal About That, a podcast where we explore various pieces of queer media and the things we love, hate, and love to hate about them. This week, we're feeling totally normal about Interview with the Vampire, the movie. Let's dive in.
What a movie this is. Oh my word. It is very much a product of its time.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, obviously it's a movie that I was aware of the existence of, even if I hadn't seen it. Like, it's one of those things that you just, the cultural osmosis exists for this movie. But, oh my god, this movie is so, I mean, I was born the year this movie came out.
Oh goodness.
Actually, wait. Yeah, this movie came out 9 days after I was born. So I did not see it, obviously, when it first came out.
Well, for anyone who wants to do the math on Nell's birthday, this movie came out November 11th, 1994. Like I said, very much a product of its time. And it is obviously based on Anne Rice's 1976 novel, Interview with the Vampire. I have not read the novel, and my understanding is that you have not read it either.
I have sure not read it.
Okay, so we're definitely discussing this specifically about the movie today, and similar to what we did with Twilight last week, you know. The big difference is we've read that book, we have not read this book, so this is just the movie that we're going on today.
Yes. And it stars Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise as Louis and Lestat, and then Kirsten Dunst as Claudia, and Christian Slater as Daniel Malloy. And it's funny because Anne Rice really did not at first want Tom Cruise to play Lestat. She was like, absolutely not, this is super bizarre. And then she was like, maybe they should switch roles, which they didn't, obviously. And then eventually, like, once she saw the full movie, she was fine with it, but
which I find interesting. It's also notable Antonio Banderas plays Armand, but he does not show up until well into the second half of the movie, and then he has a fairly small role given, like, the full extent of the movie. I actually have seen this movie, like, a number of times, and while I don't specifically recall the first time that I watched it, or, like, the impression it had on me the first time I watched it, I do remember, I think, the most distinct time that I've ever watched it was in college with one of my best friends. We, like, got together, and she had never seen it, and so we, like, made a bunch of margaritas and sat down and watched it, and it was definitely a choice because I think I forgot, like, how just sad the movie is, and not, like, in a, oh, like, a dramatic, mournful way, but just in kind of a, like, pitiful way. So we were like, oh, yeah, we're gonna have girls' night and, like, drink and watch a movie. And it was like, yeah, vampires, let's do that. And it was this movie. Bit of a downer. kind of brought the mood down a little bit. But I think I remember watching it and, like, Armand shows up and I was like, oh, right. Like, there's a whole second half to this story.
There's a lot more that happens.
It's kind of how it feels, though. I can understand it makes more sense in the book that it would kind of have this whole story with, you know, after Lestat dies, what happens that ultimately leads Louis to doing the interview with Daniel. But it does really just feel like two separate stories sort of put together in a movie because of the amount of content they cover in the very brief time that the movie runs. Because it's only, like, it's barely 2 hours.
Yeah, it's not a super long movie. Although, at that time, like, in the 90s, a two-hour movie was... We used to have standards, and movies used to be reasonably long, like, a reasonable length that you could watch in one sitting without having to stop to go to the bathroom.
Absolutely.
And we don't do that anymore. We don't do that. Anytime I see a movie that's like 90 minutes, I'm like, oh my god, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me.
I also just realized that this means that the movie opened on Veterans Day.
Huh.
Like, and it was, like, just thinking about it, like, in November, it's just such an interesting time for it to come out because it would have been, like, just past Halloween. And I feel like this movie would have made more sense if it had come out in October and, like...
Right, because this is, kind like, of, that stretch between sort of... This is around the time when, like, the holiday movies start
right.
popping. Like, those movies that you expect to be the big, like, Thanksgiving blockbusters and all of that.
Exactly.
And, like, this there's often a lot of, like, I feel family movies that come out around that time of year because they're, like, people will be out of school or whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, we'll do that. But no, please don't take your children to this movie.
Yeah, it's like a very interesting choice to have it come out then, because while it was really successful, you know, apparently it was like a $60 million budget and it made like $223 or something. So I mean, like, definitely made decent money. It just kind of is interesting to me that they did it in November. I wonder if it was just like a production thing or like what happened, because I feel like when I look at what the movie is about and like who would be watching this, it makes more sense to me to advertise it going into spooky season. But again, it was the 90s, so like who knows what kind of decisions they're making when they're putting a movie out. It was definitely a choice, you know, the casting that they made. I personally think that Christian Slater did really great as Daniel Malloy, like, mm-hmm. especially given it's a very tiny role, like, they really used him and he was very convincing. I know you said that Anne Rice eventually came around to the portrayal of Lestat by Tom Cruise. I will be honest, I am not convinced.
So here's the thing.
Performance, like, at all.
We have to talk about the scariest thing in this movie, and that is blonde Tom Cruise.
I mean,
I just remember when we started, I was like, oh no, it's so scary. This is this is horrifying. This is not a man who should be blonde.
I think what I have to remember is that this is really early on in, like, the genre fiction really becoming a thing that, like, mainstream audiences kind of, you know, watched and, like, participated in. Now it's, like, a thing. Like, you know, we've talked about Buffy or not in private conversations, but, like, we talked about Supernatural and we've talked about, like, other, you know, mainstream genre fiction shows on here. And, like, how people engage with that now and, like, how fandom is obviously a thing. But, like, in the 90s, it was kind of in that transitional period, like, coming out of, you know, Star Trek and everything else and becoming a little more mainstream, but it was still on the fringe more. And that obviously, like, had an effect on how movies were produced and put out. And, like, we talked about Twilight last week and the way that it looks and the common things that people did in order to make movies kind of have that horror feel at the time with the styling and the coloring and everything. And obviously monster makeup and, you know, movie effects and everything have gotten a lot better over the decades. But I think it does mean that a lot of these early projects really suffer a bit. And this is one of them. And I think part of what suffers, like you said, I mean, Tom Cruise is blonde, which is like a whole choice. But
no,
also,
they really,
like,
did not have to do that.
But also, like, Tom Cruise, man. Tom Cruise. Like, it's not that he's a bad actor or anything. It's just that, like, to me, when I watch this, I'm like, oh, he's not this kind of nerd.
Right. Like, Tom Cruise obviously is very well known for being in a ton of action movies and doing all of mm-hmm. these, like, big sort of stunts and Mission Impossible kind of stuff. That's really the stuff that he is kind of known for now. And, like, he was in Top Gun and Risky Business. So he's used to these sort of big action roles. I mean, he's done some other stuff. Like, he's done, like, some rom-com-y sort of things. But this... Mm-hmm. is perhaps not a role to which he is naturally inclined. And so he just...
Right.
It's just kind of silly. Like, the teeth and the hair. And obviously, like, the teeth isn't his fault, and the hair is probably not his fault either. But, like, his portrayal combined with those things just makes him really silly.
Right. Like, it doesn't... You have an idea of who Tom Cruise is, and the way he looks in this movie doesn't look natural to him, but not in a, like, vampiric way, just in, like, a little bit of a play-acting way. And then his acting and delivery feels like acting. Like, it doesn't feel like a vampire. It feels like someone acting like a vampire. And, again, like... Where was the 90s Skarsgård for this role? You know, like, that would have been the thing. I understand Tom Cruise is a choice by, like, the, you know, production company and everything. They're looking for big names of the time. And, you know, Tom Cruise was huge in the 90s and, like, would have been a get for a mainstream audience. Brad Pitt, same thing. Like, you know, you have someone who is really... well known and like in every other movie, and if you can get those actors in this movie, it's going to like pretty much guarantee success for your movie.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly it was effective. The movie was successful. But the nerd in me is just like, if you had found someone who was passionate about the material and like
right. And it's so sad. A weird because, girl? Like, well, because, like, Anne Rice wanted Julian Sands.
Oh, play. See?
Lestat.
Like.
And, like, wanted Julian Sands, and then eventually, after they cast Brad Pitt, wanted Daniel Day-Lewis, but he was like, I'm not going to play a vampire.
Sir. Which I guess makes sense to me because, like, Daniel Day-Lewis is very much that guy who's, like, all about realism and, like, putting himself in the shoes of the character and whatever else. And I'm like, of course, you can't put yourself in the shoes of the vampire. Like, you're being so extra. But, like, yeah, I'm just like, where's the weird girl casting? Where are the genre nerds who, like, right. absolutely would have come in and embodied this character and, like, delivered the performance of a lifetime, and we kind of sacrificed that for bigger fame instead in the draw of the name of Tom Cruise. And I think it paid off in terms of like financial success, but as someone who like went and watched the movie, I'm like, it's okay.
Right. It's much more like take on kind of a cult classic vibe as opposed to like a true classic film.
Yeah.
And also like I think Brad Pitt does fine in this role. I think they actually do make mm-hmm. him look sort of otherworldly and vampiric and stuff.
Yes.
But he has even said like he was miserable making the film and like had to do all these night shoots and it was just like winter and London and the script was also just like, I don't do anything and just stand around and look pretty and, like, sigh.
I mean, to be fair, that's because a lot of what Louis does.
I mean, yes, but, like, it seems like he suggested that in the book, which he's read the books, like, you get more of the sort of turmoil and discovery aspects of it. And in the movie, you get more of the, like, here's Lestat doing things, and then there's Louis, who's here too.
just to react and like judge. I will say, and we're not talking about the show today, but I do feel like, you know, AMC has made a show about Interview with the Vampire, obviously, like using the same material. And they really benefit from having the time to stretch things out and tell more of the story. One of the ways this movie really suffers is it's trying to cover all of the material of this book in one single movie. And it feels like everything just moves so quickly. And because of that, you just don't get a lot of emotional investment in like the relationship. Mm-hmm. Because you don't see a lot of actual emotional development between the relationship. Like,
right. And they definitely like covered up so much of the queerness. And I think the problem right. is that they basically covered up the interesting parts of the story. And like right. They were like, Rice was literally, when they were writing the script, she rewrote the part of Louis to be a woman to heterosexualize the relationship, and wanted it to be, and they like considered Cher for the role, and then eventually they decided to cast Brad Pitt. But I feel like they still somehow heterosexualized this queer relationship.
I feel like it manages to be fairly gay, given the fact that it's like, it feels like they're going for a fairly like non-queer portrayal. I don't think that's Anne Rice's fault. I mean, I think that is just the way that it was acted and the way that it was portrayed in the movie. It's very clear to me that they're not intending to do some kind of like special queer coding with their acting. They're not implying anything queer in the acting. They're just doing the things. And it's just that what Anne Rice wrote is incredibly gay. So it's just like, it's still gay.
Yeah. I mean, it's still very homoerotic.
Yes. But you could tell it's not like they're going for something. Like, they're just doing it, and it's like, yes, this is just inherently gay. Like, that yeah. just works for them. But again, because they're not going for something intentional here, because I don't feel like the actors are leaning into the homoerotic nature of the relationship, when I watch it, I'm just like, I don't, there's nothing like that compels me to understand their relationship. I'm like, okay, but why did Lestat pick you? Like, what about you was so intriguing to him that he turned Louis? Because there doesn't seem to be any attraction portrayed by Tom Cruise yeah. on screen. And then the whole rest of the movie, he's just bothered by Louis so much. Like, he's just like so irritated by him and so annoyed by him,
which, to be fair, if you don't know that you're queer, is a thing that happens, because you don't know why somebody gets under your skin the way they do. It's the whole like, do I want to fight them, do I want to be them, do I want to fuck them?
But I don't even get that. I just get like, he just sees Louis as just like this incredible inconvenience. He's just like, oh my god, like, what is, like, and I'm like,
why did you turn him? Just because he's pretty?
Right. I think maybe that's part of why Tom Cruise's delivery doesn't work for me, because he got the frustration that Lestat feels, but he doesn't seem to grasp the, like, attraction that Lestat would feel. So then he's just irritated, and I'm like, I wish he could have found a way to grasp both, so that it would be compelling to see Lestat be so angry, because he's like, I want you, but I want you to be a certain way, and you're not being the way that I want you. Like, that is kind of their whole dynamic, yeah. except, or at least it is in other, you know, depictions of this story that I have seen. It's just not depicted in this movie. So the whole time I'm just like, I just don't get why Lestat just doesn't leave. Like, if Louis is getting on his nerves, why doesn't he just leave.
Yeah, like, you don't have to stick together.
Right.
You could go. It's not like, you know.
Right, it's like, and it doesn't make sense why Louis stays. Like, I'm just like, he's just a dick. Like, the stat is just here being a bully. Like, there doesn't seem to be anything compelling about their relationship that explains why Louis chooses to be with him, other than he's just like, I feel like I have to. And I'm like,
yeah, it very much feels okay. Like a lack of a better things, lack of better things to do right. Relationship, which is like, it's a marriage of convenience of sorts.
Right. They're just like, well,
they're so inconvenienced by each other the whole time.
A marriage of inconvenience. Like, we're stuck with one another.
I mean, but kind of. Like, it does sort of feel like that. And it's like, okay, but you're both men. You're both rich men. It's not like one of you is
right.
A woman who doesn't have rights, who can't leave. Like, you're both rich men. You don't have to stay married.
This movie is also so clearly set in the 90s in the way that it just, like, really leans into the racism.
I mean, yeah, Louis is a plantation owner.
It's very much like, yes, this is a thing that happened then. It's not that we're saying this is okay now, except that they're definitely romanticizing it without any real, like, nuance or thought about it. And it's very uncomfortable to go back and watch.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, having never seen the movie before, it was watching it was a little uncomfy.
Yeah, there's a number of things they do that just, like, I don't know, like, really bothered me. And like you said, he's a plantation owner, and that's not, like, denied or shied away from at the beginning. It is interesting that that's not the worst part of the racial stuff that happens in this movie, is him being a plantation owner. Like, there's other stuff that's dealt with in terms of, like, specific to how he treats certain servants, and, like, some of the stuff with the sex work in here and how it's handled. And, like, just... Also, they really lean into, like, the, like, voodoo beliefs and stuff of the black population in Louisiana, but, like, in a way that feels very demeaning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. There's just several things that they do that I'm like, this doesn't feel great. And it doesn't help that, I mean, like, Armand is essentially, like, Italian or Spanish. He's, like, Roman. Yeah. So, I mean, he is a person of color, but there's not really any other vampires of color. And, like, Armand is at least fairly white passing in the movie, or, like,
yeah,
closer to white than the black servants or black slaves represented in Louisiana. So there's just, like, some weird stuff there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there were choices made.
I know you said it made you a little uncomfortable watching it for the first time. Like what did you think about it, or, like, how did that feel, I guess, to, like, see what they were doing beyond just the slavery aspect of it, and, like...
Right. I mean, obviously, like... Again, I was born the year this movie came out, and so it's just such... So my understanding of the 90s is very much... in many ways through the media that I consume, and through stories I'm told from people and, like, photos I have. Like, I don't remember 1994 as the year. I was barely alive for any of it. I was...
Right.
I was gestating for the vast majority of that year, and thus was not particularly aware of societal trends. I think it's sort of one of those things that feels very like, at the time, this would have been very common to treat these sort of characters and subjects this way. With sort of a lack of nuance and recognition of, like, what the experience would actually be like and, like, how the things they're portraying. So there was, like, a whole period of time where people got very into this idea of, like, colorblind storytelling. And this was sort of just in the period before that, I think, where it's like, they're aware, obviously, that there are racial dimensions, but they're trying to move towards the races, like, we don't see color kind of deal, which is a form of racism, because,
it's cultural erasure and, like,
it's cultural
erasure people's experiences.
Yeah, I mean, it ignores the very real lived experiences of people of color, and tries to act as though everything is the same, and, like, societally, culturally, historically, it's not.
Right.
And so I think it falls into that period, like, right before that became a big deal, which thankfully we seem to have mostly moved past now as well, because it's just, like, it's cringy in a way where you go, like, they're trying to be not woke, because I don't think that's what they were doing, and, like, that wasn't really a thing that was talked about, but they're almost uncomfortably aware of the racial dynamics here, but are leaning into them in the wrong way.
Yes. I think around this time in the 90s, like you said, we eventually get into the trend where movies more or less were just like, oh, yeah, we'll cast whoever without consideration of, like, what the race of the person cast would mean for this story. We're colorblind to the casting or whatever. But I think leading up to that, one of the things they really got into was having, like, movies that were white movies and movies that were black movies or movies with, you know, black stories or black casts. And those movies often were, like, treated differently and tended to lean, like, more heavily into, like, certain stereotypes. A lot of times because they were still written by white people or had, like, you know, were heavily influenced by, like, white creators and tended to come across as, like, white savior movies or...
Yes.
Like, or were like, knowingly and intentionally written, like, by black creators, like, for black audiences, which is great, but it meant that, like, studios valued them less and, like, put less money and less resources towards the creation and production of those movies. Because they were just like, not everyone's going to want to watch this. Like, white audiences aren't going to go watch this movie. And so it was, like, you know, diminished efforts. Notably, some of the biggest movies from 1994 are, like, Pulp Fiction. Little Women came out that year. Forrest Gump was out. The Mask, like... Those were some of the bigger movies. And then Shawshank Redemption came out. It is one of, like, the movies of the year that I think was really strong for having, like, black character representation in a story that is primarily white. And actually, like, you know, like, leaning into some of that.
I've seen apparently very few movies from this time period.
You're like, definitely... no.
No, like, I've heard of them. But.
But like I mean I'm literally looking at the list and I'm like, okay, I've shockingly seen more of these movies than not, which is wild. But like there are movies on this list that center stories about people of color, like I Like It Like That and Fresh and Fist of Legend, like the Jet Li movie. But like there's all of those movies, like I said, are like stereotypical stories or like ideas of what you'd imagine if you're like, hey, think about like a movie that like centers, you know, black characters or that centers like, you know, Asian characters or whatever. Like those are like the kind of stories I think that you would be more likely to come up with for like the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's not, I don't know how to say what I'm saying. Although I feel like it's very like segregated in the way that they're like still presenting stories in movies and the way that they're like casting. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear to me looking at the list that it's just like very, very, very whitewashed and very white centric still in the storytelling. And so it makes sense to me that, you know, whatever, I don't know a lot about Anne Rice, so I don't know what her approach was and if her intent was to come at the material this way. Mm-hmm. With leaning into some of the stuff racially that happens in this movie, but like whether that was her intent or it just was what ended up on the screen, it's tough to watch because I'm like, even when they're not shying away from the fact that the white characters in this movie are dangerous to the black people in the movie, they're still managing to be really demeaning of the black mm-hmm. characters in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know how much I love to talk about impact versus intent.
Yeah.
Intent versus impact and how it doesn't matter. Like, I say this all the time. I don't know that I've ever said it on this podcast, but like communication is inherently something that requires multiple people.
Mm-hmm.
And if the thing I say, you understand something different from it, that means I have failed at communicating my intent.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that that's like on me. But
mm-hmm.
I know that there are differing opinions on that in the media world, and there will be like, I don't understand why nobody understood what I was going for. It's like, well, that sounds like you fucked up. So
right, like you just didn't deliver things the way that it
that was that on you
wanted. Like, try again or not. Sometimes
you considered that you could do better, or just not do any. Yeah, have right. you considered maybe you just don't have any business doing any of this?
Right.
So
oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I don't know where I was going with that.
I do think that, like I said, it seems like this movie just in general, I'm not sure what Anne Rice's intentions were for it, but it feels like a lot of the people that were involved just maybe didn't have clear intention on like what they were going for or how they wanted it to be delivered in terms of both like the storytelling of like stuff with race dynamics and also like the queer coding and homoeroticism of it all. But like it does still land like I said, a lot of that homoerotic tension, and specifically the vampirism of it all and the scenes that primarily center like their vampiric nature and like their, you know, the conversion of Louis and like the biting and eating of the people, you know, really like hammers a lot of that home. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is When I watch it, I'm like watching Lestat like bite Louis and whatever and change him, and I'm just like, well, how do people watch this and not like see it?
Right. I don't know. It's like people, sometimes I think people put their straight goggles on and they just can't. They're like, I will not perceive. You could have so much more fun if you did.
It's just really funny because I'm like, okay, like this is just happening. Like he's just like, I don't know, like biting along his neck and like cradling him like up to his face and everything, and like yeah. It's a whole thing. And like I could get it where they're just like, oh, it's not like that, if it wasn't for the fact that later in the movie they make him feeding on people and stuff like an inherently sexual thing.
Right.
But like it's so explicitly clear that what he's doing when he's feeding on their victims and everything is sexual, like when he like bites her breasts and everything, and like she's there for sexual purposes. I'm like, so you are saying that it's sexual then?
Right. I guess it's gay. That's fine.
Right. They're like, we're gonna sidestep that by making it a lady in the room. There's two of them, but there's still a lady there. Like,
ah! Right. Sometimes three is company.
Well, and sometimes three is like a mistaken attempt to fix a bad marriage.
Well, I mean, I think we have to talk about the Claudia situation in this movie.
Oh, the Claudia situation. So Kirsten Dunst has talked a little bit about her experience filming this movie, and apparently for her, it actually was a really great experience. Obviously, she's very young when the movie was filmed, and she basically talked about how, like, very, like, sweet and gentle Tom and Brad both, like, were with her, and, like, basically the way they treated her, like a little sister or something, and just, like, made her feel very safe with them. Obviously, the dialogue leans towards very adult, but, like, they still, like, kept her feeling very safe. Mm-hmm. She said one of the things that the directors did with her is, like, it obviously wouldn't have worked to, like, direct her as an adult and tell her, like, this is what's happening in the scene that you need to react towards. So she said that basically what they would do is give her a scenario to react to that would result in, like, a similar expression or reaction. So they could capture that without having to, like, delve into mm-hmm. adult topics and themes with her. And she was like, obviously, I also got to, like, dress up and look very cute and, like, yeah, you know, wear these really fun clothes. Costumes. She really did. They do a great job with her costuming and the design. So it is nice to know that, you know, in the 90s, when there's definitely a lot less protections for child actors, you know, she was able to be in this movie that's clearly for adults and, like, still have a really great experience. As far as her character, though, man, like, Claudia just suffers in this movie.
Yeah. So she, in the movie, they find her, Louis finds her during the plague outbreak,
mm-hmm.
and Lestat turns her into a vampire to try to get Louis to stay. He's like, this will make my husband stay, is if mm-hmm. we have this child. And so basically they raise her. Of course she doesn't age, but like mentally she does.
Mm-hmm.
She and Louis are very close, and she's quite a vicious little thing, and Lestat seems to find that both amusing and at times amusing and at times really frustrating.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely, because he's like endeared to the fact that takes after him in some ways, but he's also annoyed that he has to continually clean up her mess. Like,
right. So he doesn't mind that she's, like, extremely murderous and vicious.
Mm-hmm.
He just wishes that she did it in a less conspicuous way.
Yes. It kind of reminds me of, like, there are parents, typically fathers, but, you know, parents who have this idea of, like, what their kid is going to be, and they're like, oh, yes, they're going to be like me, and I will mold them and shape them, and they're going to be this, and then, like, they have to deal with the reality of their child, and they're just like, ugh, a child. Like, why do you have to act like a child? Why do you have to be like a child?
I know, like, I know. It's like, well, she's, like, supposed to be 9 or 10 years. She's little.
Right.
She's
right.
Young. Like, of course she's acting like a child.
Right. Like, she's a kid. And he's just like, and the obviously the difficult part is, you know, children can be difficult. Like, that is just, I mean, speaking as, again, a parent, like, who has a 10-year-old, this is not me complaining at all about my child. Like, I adore my child, but, like, being a parent is challenging because children are challenging. Like, they test you and push you, and they're still learning and growing and developing, so they do things that you're just like, oh my god, like, how, like, okay, yeah, you clearly, I mean, haven't learned past that.
Well, right, because children are still developing their sense of identity and self, which means that, right, they're going to inherently try things out to see, mm-hmm, what they like and who they like being. But children also have a deep, like, this, from a developmental perspective, children, mm-hmm, have a deep need to feel safe. And the way that children feel safe is by pushing and testing the boundaries around them.
Absolutely. Because
they want to make sure that the boundaries will stay. Like, they need that sense of boundary,
mm-hmm,
to feel secure. And that's why you'll often get a time in, like, the preschool, kindergarten age where the parent who was maybe the closest to a child will suddenly be like, my kid hates me. All they do is not, they never do anything I tell them, like, ask them to. Mm-hmm. All they do is make things frustrating. It's like, that's because they trust you so much, because they know that they can push and push and push and that you will still be there because they're trying to test the boundaries of their world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a little bit of that with Claudia at times, because even if her mind ages, like, there is a way in which she's still stuck developmentally in,
right,
the perspective of a 10-year-old. And so there is some of that where she's trying to navigate this new world, this huge change in her life, while also still being stuck in a very specific body and, like, brain and age.
Right.
And so, like, it makes the relationship she has with them a little unusual, and especially, like, mm-hmm, with Louis.
Right. Well, and the benefit of, you know, being a parent of a human child is that your child does age and does develop. And so, like you said, you know, they're in preschool and they're pushing and they're testing the boundaries, and children continue to do that in different ways, basically, until they're grown. And even then, you know, people continue to, like, check boundaries. But, like, you know, they really do that in different ways. And there's a relief in that as a parent, because you know, we're going through this now, but it will eventually change. Whatever we're going to face next may be equally difficult, but it will at least be different. There will be, right, something new, something changed. And part of what Lestat is clearly bothered about is the fact that, like, Claudia doesn't change. So he's, like, again, irritated because he's forced to deal with who she is, and he wants her to be different, and, like, he's trapped her as a child, so she cannot change. And then he resents her for not being able to change, and I'm like, but you made her that way. And Louis very much, like, just projects all of his emotional garbage, like, onto his relationship with her, and basically, like, makes her his daughter, sister, mother, lover, therapist.
Right. Like, okay, so that's the thing I wanted to talk about, because there are times where the way he interacts with her is very much like parent and child, but there's also very much times where he, like, some of her lines, she'll say things like, Louie, my love, and I'm like, that's, like, there's this weird, and it's not even incestuous, because they're not actually related, but a blurring right. of the like, dynamic there, where it's like, are they, is she his child? Is she his little sister? Are they romantically entangled? And I, there's no real answer, because it's kind of, yes, is the answer.
Right, it's kind of everything.
Which is just sort of deeply uncomfy to watch when you're watching this young girl sort of like, my darling Louie, we'll be together forever. It's like, oh.
It is one of the few things in the movie that I actually feel like is delivered fairly well, because it, like, it's questionable, but it's not, like, it doesn't quite cross the line. Like, it verges on pedophilic, but it's not, like, inherently that.
Right. And it's not like we ever, like, see anything like that happen.
Physically. Right. I watch it and I don't actually think there is, like, sexual attraction between Claudia and Louie, or any kind of, like, or any intent to, like, have that kind of relationship between them. It's more like this deep emotional codependency that, like, prevents them from having clear boundaries in their relationship. And, like, obviously she's trapped in the body of a little girl, but she is aging.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but, like, she's still dependent on him. Like, she's literally dependent on him, because she is trapped in the body of a child to do things for her and provide things for her and, like, offer her a relationship with the rest of the world. Like, she is his connection to, or he is her connection to the rest of the world. And in turn, like, because he's not getting any kind of, like, real emotional connection to Lestat, and because he feels cut off from the rest of the world, she is the source of, like, all of his emotional need being met. So he's going to her for everything. And I think he justifies relying on her for more than should be expected of your child by arguing that, like, she isn't his child, or she isn't a child. Like, in reality, she's not a child. So he's like, I can treat her like an adult, except when he doesn't like her desire for independence. And then he's like, but no, you're my daughter. Like, you're a child. Right. You need me.
There is a, this is another one of my very favorite topics, parentification, which I've also not had as much.
Yes.
You're like, oh, yeah, for sure. Which I also have not had very much cause to talk about on our podcast. But just this, there is a type of parentification, which is when a child is sort of put in the role of an adult in a way that is developmentally inappropriate. And so a parent treating their child like their emotional support is a real thing that does happen. And sort of relying on a child to, like, be the source of emotional comfort for them. And that is kind of what happens here. In a lot of ways. And it's not fair to Claudia, because she's already dealing with the hardest thing, which is that she is going to age mentally and always be in the body of a child. And at the same time, there is no clear role defined for her.
Yeah, and, like, also, I mean, we didn't, like, I said this at the beginning, but we didn't really get into it, but, like, this is genuinely, like, Lestat's way of trying to fix the relationship he has with Louie, and basically bind Louie to him, is to be like, oh, yes, we have a daughter together. Like, this is our child. And, like, you know, we could hash this out all day, but, like, there is valid reason for why people who are in marriages that are not working to separate rather than try to stay together for the children, because ultimately, like, you're not benefiting your children to be with someone that you are resentful towards and do not have a good relationship with. Like, one, you'll end up taking those things out on your children, but also, like, you're teaching your child that this is what relationships look like and modeling toxic relationships for them. And, like, you know, when we talk about Claudia being a child, that is one of the things, is she's forever trapped as the child of parents who would be better off divorced and, like, aren't. And they're arguing, like, they're basically using her as the reason to not get divorced. And, like, I understand why it makes her so resentful. And she's like, no, we need to get rid of Lestat because it's the only way we could be free. She's like, he's awful. And, like, I'm stuck with him and I'm stuck with this. And, you know, for whatever reason, she is more drawn to Louis, probably because he, like, again, they have that emotional codependency. So it is on both sides. And she's like, yeah, if I'm going to choose, I'm going to choose the parent or the adult figure that I, like, have that strong emotional attachment to. But it sets her up for a lot of struggle because, like, she's 10 forever or 8 or however old she is, and she's stuck in this home with these pre-divorced parents, but, like, without the hope that a 10-year-old would have of either this will get better or one day I can leave. Like, she's like, no, it'll never get better and I can never leave. I'm stuck with them forever because I'll never age.
Yeah. And so she's like, so clearly the only solution here is murder.
Right. And she doesn't even have peers to, like, help her with this. No. Because she's, you know, stuck. She can only go out at night. And, like, she doesn't see children her age. And she's not allowed to have relationships with people. Like, she's very much trapped in this home with these two individuals who resent each other and are using her as, like, a bargaining chip in their relationship.
Yeah. And so finally, like, they do this thing where they kind of get rid of Lestat. There, I have to say that right. These two people are terrible at murder.
Yes. They try. You know what? They do resort to murder, even if it fails.
Yeah, they try a couple times. Because they try to kill him, but they dump him in a swamp. And then he comes back, and Louis sets him on fire, and he still is alive.
Yes, like, it just... Yeah, they're not very successful. So, it is interesting to me that basically once Lestat is gone, Claudia is, like, the one leading their relationship and, like, directing them on what they're going to do and where they're going to go.
Right. Well, that's because Louis is kind of a wet towel in this movie. He's just a bit of a damp towel.
I think it says a lot about him personality-wise, and again, also the codependency that he just naturally develops with other people in his life, that he just, like, how did you go from being this influential plantation owner with, like, all of this responsibility to someone who basically can't even make the most basic of decisions? Like, I don't understand him in this movie. I get him in other depictions, because obviously we get more of his personality, but in this movie it's just like he kind of becomes a shell of himself and is just like, ah, yes, like, I'll just let this child lead me where she wants to go, because what else do I have?
Right. You could have a good time, dude. That's allowed. But no, instead they go to Paris. And things don't go great.
No. They meet Santiago and Armand and the rest of their group there. It's clear pretty quickly that Claudia is very jealous of the relationship that forms between Louis and Armand and is very protective over him.
Right.
And again, I'm like, this makes sense to me from a lot of different angles. Like, one, again, the codependency is, like, strong. But also I'm kind of like, despite the fact that she kind of led the charge on killing Lestat, like, she did so from the perspective of a child who wants their parent all to themselves, and suddenly hears someone new coming in, like, dad's got himself a new boyfriend and is looking at dating again, and she's like, excuse me, I thought it was just you and me now, like, me and dad.
Yeah. Like, do you remember the last time I had another dad? Didn't go great.
Right, like, what are you doing? Why are you looking to replace him with a new dad? I don't like this new dad either. Who am I gonna have
to
murder
to get some attention around here?
Right! Exactly. She's just like, no. And I think it's fascinating then that, like, her response to that is basically like, you know what? What I actually just need is a mom. Like, you dads all suck. And, like, I just need a different parent because I'm clearly, done like, with men. This isn't working. Yes, she's like, it's just not working for me. Like, what she wants is the love and affection of a parent, and she's just like, I thought getting rid of Lestat would mean that you would give me your undivided attention as my parental figure, and turns out you just went and got yourself a new boyfriend instead. So I'm gonna go find me a new parent.
Correct. Yes. And unfortunately that goes very poorly because it's against the rules to, well, they get punished for murdering Lestat, even though he's fine. Yeah. Ish.
Right, like,
he's,
that's always what gets me. They're like, ah, he's dead. And I'm like, but he's not even dead, though.
He's like, he is drinking the blood of rats, but he's fine-ish.
Right. He's just, like, sadly wallowing in a decrepit old house, like.
Correct. Yeah, but so Claudia and Madeline get burned to ash. And it's very sad because you, so sad. Like, we don't actually get much from Madeline and Claudia. Like, they basically just show up and she's like, this woman, she needs to be my companion now. And Louis is like, yeah, maybe not. And Claudia's like, I have asked for so little. Give me this. And then he's like, okay. And then they get burned to death. And so it's right. Like, it would have been nice to get more of, like, who Madeline is and how they met and became close. But we see that when they burn, Madeline is, like,
holding Claudia.
Hold Claudia and protect her.
I do actually find the little bit that we see of Madeline in this movie pretty compelling. Because, you know, Louis's frustrated. He's trying to push her away and basically be like, you don't know what you're asking of me, and like, yada yada, and like, do you understand like what's happening? And she's like, yes, like, I'm a mother who lost a child, and like, I'll be her mother, and she's a child to me who won't die. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, people, there's been different depictions of Claudia in media and, like, different understandings of who she is and, you know, why Anne Rice wrote her and made her the way that she was. But it's notable that, you know, Anne Rice lost a child and then chose to write Claudia. And, like, that line specifically sticks out to me. You know, she's a child who won't die, like, given to this mother who lost a child, and they have this immediate and like deep emotional connection where Madeline is like committed to her and is like, yes, like, and it's easy to look at it and be like, oh, Madeline just wants a new kid. But I, from the way that she commits herself to Claudia, I do think that like, there's something in Claudia that she connects to.
Right.
That
right.
She's like, it's not just like, I want a new daughter, but it's like, she could be my daughter. And like, I could love her because she doesn't just see her as like a replacement. Like, she's also like, she's someone in need of a mother. Like, I could be that for her. And it like, makes it all the more tragic then that her whole idea going into it is like, she needs a parent who will actually love her, and I need a daughter to love that will not die, and then they immediately die.
But at least they're together.
They are together, but it's just, I mean, and, like, it's just so sad then that, like, you know, basically Claudia was raised in this home where, like, she wasn't really shown love in a way that was, like, safe for her. Like, it, again, it was very conditional and, like, very codependent. And the minute she's finally offered something like that, where she can be loved and valued the way that she is, she's punished for it.
Literally, this poor little girl. Her mother dies of the plague, she gets turned into a vampire, and then spends the rest of her life having the worst time.
Right, like, it just sucks. Like, it just sucks so bad. And it's interesting, too, because Louis is obviously, like, devastated over this, and righteously angry. So he then goes out and, like, destroys the Theater of Vampires in, like, a fit of rage. But I'm just like, where was that energy before? Like, where was that energy for your daughter before she was burned up to a crisp? Like,
yep. Not appearing in this movie, apparently, because
it's just, again, Madeline is in this movie so little, but it's just, like, a very interesting way of contrasting how people perceive the role and emotional responsibilities of mothers versus fathers. That, like, Madeline was there to care for Claudia in, like, an emotional way and meet her needs and, like, provide, like, a very specific kind of role for her, and, like, that's how she fulfills the role of a good mother, is, like, through that emotional support and care. And, like, Louis's job as the father figure is to, like, protect and defend his daughter, and so, like, when bad things happen to her, he reacts with anger and violence and everything. And I just point that out because it's something I hear a lot, like, from men, especially in American society and, like, modern fathers. But, like, even as, you know, from the 90s and be even before that, is this idea of, like, my job is to, like, provide and protect. Like, if something happened to my family, if someone threatened my family, I would react with violence, because, like, I will, you know, if someone is going to come into my home, I will stop them, I will do this thing. And it's like,
right,
but they don't want to do a lot of the other like, they don't want to provide a lot of the emotional support or a lot of the other things, because they're like, well, that's what moms are for. Like, it's wild that this movie kind of points that out. I don't even think it tried, it just managed to do it. It was like, hey, Louis was kind of failing to provide any kind of emotional support for Claudia because he was too caught up in his, you know, new boyfriend or whatever. So Claudia literally found a mother figure to provide the things that he would not provide. And then when she was harmed, he was like, yes, now I will rush to defend her. And, like,
right,
vengeance
she,
for her.
She dies, and he's like, well, now I don't want my new boyfriend anymore.
Right. Like, everyone must suffer. Like, okay.
Screw you guys, I'm going home.
Right. And then he does. He just leaves and is like, ah, yes, like, I'm going to go home and I'm going to, you know, see if my old boyfriend is there so that I can just be like, I am smarter and better now, and I'm not going to make those same mistakes. I'm going to leave you here to suffer, and
well,
I'm going to be
home,
sad
yeah.
and miserable and alone.
Yeah, he, like, travels around for over 100 years by himself, all he having a big mope, and then he goes home to New Orleans and finds Lestat, and Lestat's like, I'm sorry for turning Claudia into a vampire. Will you be my boyfriend again? And Louis's like, no, I don't want a boyfriend. I'm leaving again.
Singleness all the way.
Yeah. I can't have a boyfriend. I don't deserve a boyfriend.
Right.
And then he, I guess, goes and does this interview with Malloy. And then, like, basically gets real mad and runs away and is like, ugh.
Which, again, like, it calls into question, like, what is the point of this interview? Like, he's just yeah. like, I'm just gonna tell this guy all of my secrets. And I'm just like, sir, you're so lonely. Like, you're so sad and so lonely. And it just, it's very clear to me that
join
he,
a
like,
book club.
He was just like, this could be, like, therapy. But, like, obviously I can't have a therapist, so I'm just gonna, like, get a reporter to come talk to me instead.
Right. Like, and then Malloy's like, I think you need a friend. Turn me into a vampire and I'll be your companion. And Louis's like, that wasn't the point of the story. And it's like, but what was the point of the story? That living an immortal life sucks? He didn't know vampires were real before this. You didn't have to do
right.
that.
Right. Right. Daniel's like, I'm not a shitbag. I can, like, be your friend and we could, like, actually have, like, a good life together. And Louis is just like, have I not explained how having a boyfriend is not working for me? Like, I'm not looking for a new boyfriend. You don't get it. Like,
I came here to explain to you why I've gotten divorced so many times.
Right. I'm not looking for a new boyfriend. Like, I'm explaining why I'm terrible to date and, like, deserving of being single. And I'm just like...
Oh my god, he's treating Malloy like his diary.
He really is! Yes, he's just like...
He's like, I don't want to write this all down, so I'll have somebody else yes! do it.
Dear diary, like, let me tell you the story of how I met the man that changed my life and why I'm single.
Yes.
Buckle in. It's gonna be a long one.
Right. And then Lestat, like, shows up and attacks Malloy and is like, would you like to be a vampire? You can have a choice. And then just, like, drives away.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, Louis might be, like, in, you know, subjecting himself to a monk lifestyle where he's single forever, but, like, Lestat is like, I would like a boyfriend. Like,
Lestat's like, I've been single for a really long time. Do you want to come over for a rat?
Right!
we could rat and chill if you want.
I tried to talk and, like, choked. That was hysterical. Come over for a rat. I'm okay. Well, I mean, like, honestly, I can't. Can you blame him? Christian Slater is hot, like, and he's volunteering to be a vampire for the rest of his life.
True.
Like, yes, take advantage of that. Turn this guy right now. Like, lock it in.
Yeah.
I do think it's funny that Christian Slater, like, sees how, like, depressingly pathetic Louis is, and is like, I'll still date you.
Sir. He's the very definition of I could fix him.
Right! I'm like, do you not have taste? Do you not have self-esteem? You're committing to this guy, the wet paper towel, for life? For eternity? For beyond life, for eternity?
Right. Yeah, like, sir... How did in any of this story did you get the sense that this would be a good boyfriend?
Well, and clearly he understands they're not going to be boyfriends forever. Like, Louis goes through them pretty quick.
Sir, you know at some point he's going to try to kill you, right? Like, that's what Louis does. He loves them and tries to kill them. Not loves them and leaves them. Loves them, attempts murder, and then leaves them.
He's like the Black Widow of vampires.
Except he's really bad at it.
So bad at it! Like, my god.
This is a really silly movie.
It's so funny, and, like, I don't know. Yes, it is silly, because, like, it's just the way it's delivered, I'm like, oh, like, nobody is taking this seriously enough. Or, like, Again, I think if everyone was, like, insanely passionate about the material and was, like, really into it, it'd be different. But it's clear, like, at minimum, like, maybe Tom Cruise isn't on the level. So he's just like, ah, yes, like, this angry guy with long teeth who likes to, like, ooh, you know, bring women home. Like, all right, sir.
Yep.
Noted. Yeah. We didn't really get into this, but I also think it's notable that there's, like, a lot of clear repression and, like, religious guilt, at least on Louis's part, that obviously affects how he operates and everything. I don't think it's delved into quite as deeply in this movie as it is in, like, mm-hmm. other depictions of the story. But, like, I just pointed out, because, again, it's one of those things that, like, is often heavily associated with queer repression. And I feel like in a different version of this story, it would be more heavily explored and something to really get into. But obviously, because this is, like, a less intentionally queer-coded version of this story, it's just kind of there as, like, a footnote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wish they'd, like, emphasized it a little more, though, because, again, I think it's one of those things that, like, explains a lot of Louis's personality, and they don't focus on it enough to, like, really explain yeah. why he's such a wet paper towel.
Yeah, there's some missed opportunities there.
Yeah.
They, like, yeah. They could have done some more. And, like, I don't know, this movie was already, I just think that maybe that, like, this isn't a book that's well suited for a movie. Because there's so much.
Yeah.
That it makes it hard to get everything into. Because I'm like, what would they have cut out to put in
right
more of that?
I mean, obviously we complained about Tom Cruise being blonde in this, but, like, watching this, do you look at it and go, oh, vampires are sexy? Like, do you feel like that this movie does a good job portraying? No, definitely not.
No, I look at this movie and I'm like, wow, vampires are whiny, pathetic, damp babies. And not damp in the hot way that sometimes when men are, like, wet and bloody and you're like, yes, this is, like, wet and bloody in the wrong way.
Yeah. Even the stuff with, like, Armand and Santiago and the other vampires later, I'm just like, oh, they've just made vampires into, like, theatrical circus clowns. Like, not in the, like, sexy Cirque du Soleil, like, elegant, beautiful kind of way, but in literally, like, the rolls up in the tiny car and 20 people get out circus clown kind of way. It just feels very, like, jokey and unserious and silly.
Yeah.
Kind of a bummer, really. Like,
I know.
I want my vampires to be hot and, like,
right.
mysterious.
I know. We've covered some bummer vampire stories so far.
Right. We're gonna have to, like, try to do better. Like, I need hot vampires in my life. I need sexy, alluring vampires that I'm like, yeah, you could kill me. That would be totally fine. As long as, like, it means your mouth is on my neck. Like, I'm just saying.
Well, we will have some opportunity going forward to cover other vampires. Because we're not done with Interview with the Vampire. We
right.
will be back to talk about the show, which is so completely different.
So different. Yes, we're going to talk about AMC's Interview with the Vampire next week. And we are going to be joined by our special guest, our friend Catherine. So stick around for that so we can talk more about this story in general and like how it's depicted on the show.
Yeah, so that'll be fun. And it does include some sexier vampires.
Yes, definitely ones I would like be willing to let bite me.
I mean, I'd be willing to like have that conversation. I'm not saying okay. Yes or no, but like we could talk.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be back to deal with that next week.
Yeah. Till then, friends.
Bye.
Bye.
Totally Normal About That is a podcast hosted and produced by Lucia and Mel. Are you feeling totally normal about something we talked about today? Is there a piece of media you feel totally normal about? We want to hear about it. You can find us on Twitter at @totallynormalAT, or you can email us at totallynormalaboutthat@gmail.com. And if you are enjoying this episode, please leave us a rating and review on your